There is no subtlety in this movie.
Okay. All right.
This is a revenge fantasy. I'm not sure which reviews you read that said that that it's restrained and it's subtle, but those are definitely not words that you should use when describing Promising Young Woman.
I guess I was reading the Me Too contingent who wants to portray the film in as a significant standout piece of sociological reflection and art or whatever, and they were they're giving it a break. They're not looking to condemn it, and they think it has something. It's delivered something that is worth worth reflecting, worth noting, worth seeing.
Right, exactly. Like the topical issues it raises are very, very are commendable, and they're definitely fascinating enough to warrant post-screening conversation. And there will be plenty of post-screening conversations happening after this movie, and mm-hmm. that's I think a very important thing.
Yeah.
But even the direction from Emerald Fennell is quite over the top. I mean, from the soundtrack to the over-stylized frames to the neon colors, this is most definitely bubblegum pop revenge fantasy. There's nothing meditative or subtle about it. We have to be clear about this because,
right.
I have seen some reviews. I've read some reviews where it is mentioned Emerald Fennell holds back on some scenes. She does. There is no holding back here.
Right.
This is even less subtleness than Death Wish.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But it is nothing short of entertaining. And if you can go into this movie with the notion that this is mostly entertainment,
mm-hmm.
But with topical relevance, that's exactly what Promising Young Woman is.
All right. Okay. Well, it sounds really like... Go ahead.
It'll be a movie that many people talk about. It's mm-hmm. going to be... you won't be able to escape this movie once it's released. And it's definitely going to make a dent on mm-hmm. the movie here. There's no doubt about it.
It really does sound, to judge by Owen's review of Birds of Prey and what you just told me about Promising Young Woman, that they are drawing from the same current, the same river of feeling and reflection and anger out there. And, at the very least, these are not dull movies. These sound like they seem similar. They seem to be birds of a feather, these two. I guess.
Yeah, but Birds of Prey is set in the comic book world, and that to me is detrimental to the overall impact it's supposed to really have on the viewer.
But it is about something, which is about rage at asshole men who are crude and dismissive and misogynist and ugly, basically. So I understand where the even if it's a comic book movie, it's drawing upon something, not perhaps in a interesting, artful way, but it is drawing upon something that's out there and that obviously has caught on, or at least in the creative community, it's caught on. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I mean, revenge porn on men is. Because this is what it is, really. It's revenge porn, and truth be told, we haven't really had many movies like these. So it is a fresh new perspective, so to speak. But the reviews for Birds of Prey are a fairly mixed bag at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It still sounds like a very comic booky, zany kind of statement that the DC EU is kind of known for by now.
Yeah.
But it has a female director behind the camera.
Yep.
interested in seeing it. I don't know if I'll like it, but
It seems to me that the I got this feeling immediately from the trailers that they're sending out that there's like level 1 or 2, there is level 3, there's level 4. This is like a level 13 in terms of delivering what it's saying in terms of asking or directing Margot Robbie to, you know, to do something special that's going to catch, you know, people's attention, you know, make you kind of stand up and or sit up in your seat and go, wow, you know, she's doing something here, you know, like the way Jack Nicholson did something with Joker, that kind of thing. And there doesn't seem to be any way to, you know, to tune these kind of performances except turn it up is all they're basically doing.
It also comes in the heels of Kitty Green, the assistant, being released just last Friday. Have you seen it?
Which one? Sorry?
Kitty Green's The Assistant. Kitty Green, a director of casting, JonBenet, has made her first feature-length film, and it has to do with... It's a very minimalist portrayal of an assistant who works for Harvey Weinstein. Weinstein is never mentioned. He's always behind closed doors, or he could be screaming at her on the phone. But this is you haven't heard about it?
Yes, I've definitely heard about it. I've definitely read about how they muffled the Harvey Weinstein identity, but it's. Very, it seems at times very specifically based upon the Weinstein saga.
And it's a stripped down drama that doesn't really go for a narrative and more goes for these little insightful moments.
Yeah.
By the way, you can edit this out. I have a link for you. I can send it to you.
Oh, please. That'd be great.
It's whether you like the movie or not, I mean, a lot of the. Details chosen to tell the story are fascinating, and supposedly the director Kitty Green, she interviewed a lot of people that were in the know about Weinstein's casting couches and about the way he operated day to day at his New York office. The attention to detail in this movie is quite interesting. I'm still on the fence on whether or not it's a great movie, but it's most definitely an entertaining one. Not an entertaining one, but a very watchable one.
Yeah.
In that it's basically a snapshot of post Me Too Hollywood and it's well worth a look. Yeah. Well worth a look.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you for the link. That would be great.
Yeah. And it's just 80 minutes, I believe. It's a very, very minimalist statement.
Well, I guess I'll do a search and expand what I was writing into a general revenge porn piece and see if I can make... You know, because that's more interesting if you get. But the old rule, going back to the days of Entertainment Weekly back in the early to mid '90s, when I was working there, is it's not a trend unless you can cite 3 distinctive, films that are that embody this trend. So you got to find. I have to find a third one.
That you mean the revenge fantasy?
Yeah. Yeah.
That have to do with women?
Yes, revenge porn, women getting back or delivering revenge and rage upon ugly, predatory beast men. Yeah, that's the idea.
Oh, but there's been a few the last few years. I mean, I'm thinking of this French movie I saw. Oh, I can't remember. You shouldn't mention Carrie, which was released 43 years ago, but I mean, recently,
I don't think that Carrie, that Brian De Palma's Carrie is in the same vein. First of all, it's in a time when there was no consciousness out there about pushing back against men and the whole Me Too thing. But there is a film that was not too long ago, maybe 3-4 years ago, but it was about a woman who's, I think it was Australian possibly, and she is almost killed and treated horribly, and you know. And,
oh, that's the movie I was trying to figure out.
Yeah.
But something tells me it's called Revenge.
Okay. All right.
I think it's called Revenge.
Okay.
And it has a Me Too stamped all over it.
Yeah.
Right. I believe it was 2018, that movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not too long ago.
No. That was brazenly entertaining to watch. No subtlety whatsoever in that movie as well. Uh-huh. And I believe it's from Australia. I'm checking right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Revenge.
Okay.
2018.
There we are.
There you go.
All right.
And the reviews were quite good. I never really particularly paid attention to it after I saw it at Sundance. It was playing Sundance in 2017 or 2018.
Okay.
But these kind of revenge fantasy movies are becoming, you know, more and more common.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so tell me, now that the 2020 Oscars have been completely sussed, and I just don't think, I think that there's a lot of people, more than a couple, who are invested in trying to, I guess, present or suggest that there is an element of suspense, actual suspense, actual uncertainty about the winners of this or that Oscar. And I don't think there's any basis at this point to say that there's any suspense with Best Picture, Director, well, maybe Director. And you know, I don't know. What do you, I mean, we all know that it's going to be 1917. What do you think it's going to be, Mendes? Most likely, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think it'll be 1917.
Yeah.
All signs are pointing towards 1917. Although, unless people decide to vote for Parasite because it is a foreign film has never won, and it is a great story. It's become, as I mentioned this word before, it's become a phenomenon, making $150 million worldwide, and you know, it's a statement by a non-white filmmaker, and it has incredible relevance in terms of the it's an upstairs downstairs piece, and it is, in a sort of way, about class division. That would be the only movie I think that could beat 1917 on Oscar night, but I don't think it will. I'm sticking with Sam Mendes. For director as well, probably, right?
Say again? What?
For director as well, right?
I mean, most likely, yeah. It feels that way. I mean, Mendes has, you know, done the charm. He's won with BAFTA and DGA, and I'm trying to think, was it, oh, obviously Producer Guild, but that doesn't award the Best Director. I don't know, it seems like that. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I would think that there's so much fervor for Parasite that I imagine that people would like to see 1917 Best Picture and Bong Joon-ho Best Director. That would be interesting. That would be something that I would find okay. You know, things didn't work out. You know, that would be actually kind of a turn on, in a way. You know, so I mean, I don't think that people like the idea of it winning two Oscars, international plus Best Picture, unless I'm completely misreading the current out there. I just don't think it's right. You know?
Yeah, it would be a pleasant surprise. Bong winning one of those two awards.
No, he's definitely going to. The Parasite's definitely winning the Best International featured.
That's a given. But I'm saying either picture or director. If he wins one of those, that would be major.
Yeah,
that was totally major. And Parasite has just crossed through the mainstream. I mean, there's this mainstream movie theater around my area that, like, they usually play DC movies, Marvel movies, whatever the latest blockbuster is, and Parasite is playing there right now, which I was totally shocked by. I mean, it's really just crossed the mainstream. But looking at the other categories, I guess it's a given that Joaquin is going to win, and that Renee Zellweger is going to win as well.
Of course.
Brad Pitt, I just can't see him losing. He's been
chance in the world. Not a fucking chance. But you know what was funny? Did you happen to read Brutally Honest Oscar piece by Scott Feinberg yesterday?
Yeah, I did.
The funniest thing, I mean, these people are always pretty, they don't really know what they're saying. They're kind of, their facts are off. Like the woman was complaining that Florence Pugh was way too old to be playing one of the younger sisters in Little Women. But she's 24. She didn't seem that old to me, you know. That kind of complaint is not fair, you know, because she doesn't seem excessively old. But I thought it was funny that she thought that Laura Dern's a divorce attorney was excessive and kind of shrieky and ranty, and she said if she behaved like that with me when I was looking for someone to represent me in a divorce, I would go right over to Ray Liotta and ask and go for him. I thought that was funny because there's been nothing but. You know, she really, it's that wonderful speech in Marriage Story, which she talks about the deification and the imprisonment, really, of women who are allowed to behave in certain ways but not in others. You know, that's really pretty cool speech, you have to admit it.
I haven't seen Laura Dern's character, or I haven't seen or read of her character being really criticized by
anybody, really.
Critics.
Yeah.
No. Because her job is to be a lawyer, and I guess that's how lawyers try to, to speak to their clients, to pump them up, to make them feel better, to make them say that they are the right party, right. And that the other party is in the wrong. I mean that's just a lawyer's job. But at the same time, I can see why some people would be irked by that character.
Yeah.
Because she's just a very strong, open-minded woman.
Yeah.
And that pisses off a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, it just comes with the territory.
Yeah.
And Ray Liotta is basically the male version of her.
Yeah, well, you know, she recognizes when she goes, uh-oh, when she hears that Adam Driver is hiring.
Yeah.
You know, here we go. You know, this is not going to be, you know, this is going to be brutal. So, you know.
Yeah, she's met her match.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so, and funnily enough, the buzz which started, for Marriage Story, which started, when Eric Cohn published his IndieWire piece in late August. About the film and how it's Baumbach's best, and it was basically it was pure marketing in a way to kick off the Marriage Story campaign.
Yeah, in exchange for our showing this film to you early, Eric, we want you to do the lead-off piece that we trust, knowing you to be a good guy, you will be sufficiently enthused about Marriage Story, and therefore. We will extend this courtesy to you.
And right after that, Marriage Story ended up gaining all these glowing reviews at Telluride and then at Venice. And it hit a bit of a snag in Toronto in a way, in that it was overshadowed by other movies. But I think people have come back down to earth when it comes to Marriage Story. It's at the end of the day, it's a Noah Baumbach movie, and he's for peculiar tastes. It is his most accessible movie in a way. Yes, it's not Greenberg, I've spoken to plenty of people that don't were lukewarm on Marriage Story, and I think whatever buzz Eric Cohen and Netflix were trying to create, it just fell flat as the season went along.
Yeah, I think that really the whole Adam Driver thing arguably peaked during Telluride. I mean, that was like the big moment. I mean, because they decided, Julie and Tom, they decided that, you know, that Adam's really reached a kind of a critical mass, and he's really the guy, and so let's do a tribute to him and the whole thing. And everybody bought into it, naturally, because I was pretty positive about the film when I first saw it. I didn't have any major issues at all, except, and the only thing, when you look back at Marriage Story, the only thing that has vaguely bothered me, vaguely, is that I always felt that there is something not quite full and complete about Scarlett Johansson's character, deciding that the only response to the frustration and feelings of suppression, not being heard, not being listened to, not being asked what she needs, that kind of thing, that the only response was to bolt out of New York City, take the young son, move in with her mom, and initiate divorce proceedings. It just seemed, don't people try to work things out, at least for the sake of the child, and then when there's no alternative, when people haven't been receptive, when the husband's not listening, or whatever, then you go to divorce if there's just not working out. But she seems like she jumped right into that. And
she looked selfish in a way, and I don't know if it's necessarily accurate to the character, but I mean, Baumbach could have elaborated a little more about her reasons why she did all this, right. But he doesn't really fully delve into that. We know it's because, like, she feels like her husband has stymied her chances at becoming, you know, a lead actress.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be the main reason,
right,
Baumbach lays down for wanting the divorce.
Yeah, yeah.
But I feel like there were other reasons why, but they're just not dealt upon. I mean, she felt like she was losing her independence in a way. But I would have liked that to have been elaborated a little, mm-hmm, a little more further.
I'm very sorry about the whole thing. I feel kind of wounded and regretful about the whole thing, because the whole Marriage Story thing, which I was, nobody wanted to go there, but nobody wanted to touch the understory that because Baumbach is basing it upon his own marriage, and particularly his own divorce, and everybody was talking about how the reason, real reason, the most provocative reason why he and Jennifer Jason Leigh decided to call it quits was not him not listening to her or whatever issues they may have had, but a fact that he fell in love with somebody else. And you're not supposed to say this, because it's, de Baumbach couldn't say this because he couldn't characterize his current partner, Greta Gerwig, in a light of being a homewrecker. And it would be, disastrous from their personal point of view. I mean, I doubt they're, and everybody understands the whole dynamic. So I just, you had to let it go. But the reason that it felt incomplete was that wasn't part of it, And we all kind of know what probably happened. We don't know, but we are very persuaded that this is probably a big part of it. So anyway,
Jennifer Jason Leigh has been pretty quiet in that regard. She hasn't really spoken out, and also, the media is not going to castigate Greta Gerwig. She's the it girl right now,
Right.
It's their own personal issues. Baumbach was allowed to put whatever personal details.
Right.
He wanted in this movie. He was allowed to omit any as well. But
right.
So it's not, to me, it wasn't an issue. It was just, I liked Marriage Story. I just felt it was an incomplete.
Well, listen, apart from what I've said, and apart from whatever issues you may have, the fact is, that movie never took flight in the award season. It was just a yes, it's a good film. Yes, it moved me, or yes, it's good, but it was disturbing because I've been through a divorce myself, that kind of thing. So it never really caught on. I mean, it's never been like, oh, it's likely to. The whole thing has been boiled down to Laura Dern for many months now, all through most of the season.
I mean, the Telluride buzz pushed it as far as it could, but yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, it wasn't the kind of movie that was going to go far. Mm-hmm. Again, I mean, I really think it started with that IndieWire Eric Cohn piece, and that did right. as much as it could mm-hmm. to push that movie towards Oscar season. But mm-hmm. I mean, and now it's middle of the pack or right. even lower in terms of Oscar odds. Right. It's completely fallen flat on the ground. And again, I mean, it's a good movie.
Right.
So we're not bashing it in any way here. I just think there were better movies released this year. So
now, how about a quick sum up? And we'll bring it to a close here. A quick sum up of what has been the final verdict about Sundance 20. The general feeling that I have detected is that over the last 2-3 years, it's become increasingly its own kind of woke realm, instructive, socialist summer camp in the snow, that sort of thing. And that coupled with the fact that movies that exude the Sundance mythology or have that Sundance stamp, if you will, they don't really play theaters anymore. They go straight to streaming, which is fine, and obviously more people see it. But at the same time, it doesn't seem to really resonate in the culture. You know, it kind of just goes into that Bermuda Triangle thing. So I think that right now Sundance is just a chilly, cold South by Southwest.
Yeah, I think it was a fairly recent thing that happened to Sundance. It really started, I guess, last year. Last year was when we started to sound the alarm bells. I felt the year prior was fairly strong. 2016, 2017, 2018 were fairly strong additions, but last year you had a lot of the festival hits bombing at the box office, mm-hmm. and you basically had one Oscar contender for Best Picture come out, and the farewell ended up not getting nominated, really.
That was a shame, because I tell you, when you said you were really like moved to tears by The Farewell, and I kind of a little skeptical when I was listening to you.
Yeah.
And then I saw it and I realized, you're right. It does really, it understands something. It delivers a certain current that I related to. It's about families and, I really think that was a major film, and it was a shame that it wasn't one of the...
It was a very humane film.
Yeah.
And just universally relatable because who doesn't care about family and loved ones? There are people out there, but I mean, it's a fairly universal theme that mass audiences could easily relate to.
Right.
And Aquafina was great. She, I find she deserves to be part of the five acting nominees, and she didn't get it.
Right.
But this year, I don't even think there's a Farewell this year. I mean, Minari was the best reviewed movie, and in a way, it felt like the Farewell in that it is a love letter to grandmas everywhere, and it's an Asian based movie as well from Korea. This one. But there's, but it's very subdued and very a little too subtle and minimalist to really make a dent in next year's Oscar race. Really, you go in to Minari, just temper your expectations when you go in there, because it's not the second coming. We didn't get a Manchester by the Sea, a Boyhood, a Call Me by Your Name this year. this was very much a Sundance Film Festival geared towards small movies, small dramas that hit you hard, and that's fine. That's good. You know, I like your theory that every Sundance has around six or seven keepers, because this Sundance had around, I would say, six or seven keepers. Will these keepers, you know, will they translate to audiences? I don't know. I really, really, really don't know. There's Anthony Hopkins' great performance in The Father that could last throughout the year. I don't think Minari will really have a lasting impact, but that's just me. Promising Young Woman will have people talking, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Palm Springs might be a big hit. We're in desperate need of a funny comedy, and that could do the trick.
Well, Palm Springs was purchased for $17 million, was it?
$15 million.
And 69 cents more than the buy for what was the film that was the high watermark?
The Birth of a Nation.
Birth of a Nation. Right.
Nate Parker's. Yeah. They purposely broke that record by 69 cents.
Right. Okay.
So that stain Sundance can get rid of that stain.
Yeah.
Because.
Yeah.
That was quite the story, and it'll be for another podcast. But the story of Birth of a Nation and Nate Parker is something that we could definitely delve into for another hour.
Yeah. One last thing. It seems to me that in the wake of Io, which was a debacle, of course, but the fact is that the likelihood is that the Democratic primary race between Howe and the convention is going to be between Bernie and Pete. Bernie being the left purist, we've got to have a revolution. We can't just beat Trump, but we have to, you know, basically change over the whole emphasis of government. We have to be much more of a, you know, kind of a social liberal democracy in the Finland or the Nordic vein in Europe. And Pete, basically, as somebody described him, he's a 38-year-old guy with a mind and a soul of a 65-year-old guy. He's moderately liberal, practical, but he's certainly no visionary and revolutionary. At least he doesn't seem to be. And that's what's basically left, because I don't think Biden's going to, you know, unless something extraordinary happens in New Hampshire, right? I mean, it's going to be those two, it seems to me.
It's got to be those two. Biden has been flailing in the polls, and Warren is just not getting the momentum she wants, and Klobuchar is hanging by a thread, and I guess the Democratic Party wants to boost Bloomberg up there, so much so that they changed the rules for him to be part of the debates.
You know, I like Michael Bloomberg. I mean, yes, he's buying his way in, but he's still Michael Bloomberg. He's a compelling fellow. He's got an excellent record as a mayor. I mean, he's not my idea of any, you know, they hate him because he's rich and because he's not really with the Bernie side of things. And he's practical and, you know, moderate liberal, not exactly a flaming progressive, but he's palatable from the perspective of people that wants a sane government that's not going to be crazy and destructive like the Trump thing.
Anyway. Well, he's trying to buy his way into a nomination, and I think that irks some people. I mean, he's planning on spending up to $1 billion when all is said and done. And that's why he's kind of the de facto third place candidate right now after Bernie and Pete.
Yeah.
So we'll see if he can rise up. But if you know the powers that be within the Dem establishment, they want one of their own to get elected, I guess Bloomberg has a better chance now than Biden.
What's scary to me, of course, is that even though people seem to be coming to this conclusion that they just don't think Biden has the. He just doesn't have a lot of engine, a lot of fuel. Give me a second. I'm sorry. Hang on.
Hi, come on.
Can you come up for me?
Just go downstairs, parking lot number three downstairs.
Number three, okay.
The third number three.
Okay.
And you don't, yeah. Okay. I'm sorry, it's the cleaning person that just arrived. Sorry.
Yeah, no problem.
What I'm afraid of is that even though Pete has a nice start having come out on top in Iowa, he's going to hit a wall with the African American voters in South Carolina, and God knows how many states in Super Tuesday, and it just scares the living daylights out of me that with Pete hitting a wall with that sector of the voting public, which is essential. For all, they're just not going to budge. Are they going to stick with Joe no matter what? I mean, what are they going to do? What are African American voters going to do? I mean, to hear it from all analysts, there's just no way they're going to go with Pete because they've got this thing in their head that he's not for them and he's not on their side, which is bullshit. But that's the way they see it. The way they see it is that he's not their guy. So what's going to happen? What could happen?
I mentioned it the other time in the last podcast we did, but sadly, Mayor Pete has a major disadvantage in the fact that he is gay. Because, as you call them, the bumblefucks out there, they're not going to vote for a gay candidate. Did you see the video of the woman that voted for Pete?
And she didn't know he was gay.
And he's gay. And she freaked out. I mean, you know what? You know what? She's probably not the only one that would freak out that voted for Pete. And then they found out he was gay. I'm sure there were plenty of others like that. At the end of the day, this is America, and there is still homophobia, and a lot of people don't want their candidates, let alone their president, to be gay, which is a scary thing, of course, to think about. But it is what it is, right?
I think it's the thing that made me laugh about that video is that this is a portrait of a lot of the people out there who consider themselves involved. Citizens involved in democracy. She didn't even know he was gay. How many months have people been talking about people? And she missed that. I mean, that tells you of the bubble, of the foxhole that people were living in. She just didn't even know it. It was amazing.
But she's supposed to be a Democrat voter.
Yeah.
I don't understand how you can be a Democrat and be this homophobic.
Well, I guess it's a big tent.
Yeah.
It's a big tent. They don't like, who knows.
Yeah.
But it's scary, because the idea of, like, what's going to happen is, if it turns out to be Bernie, I don't think it's not going to work out. Trump's going to win. What?
If it's Bernie, the Democratic Party will never be the same again. You know that.
Yeah.
Because he represents... he would be representing the ideology of Democratic voters,
uh-huh.
And what an ideology it is.
Yeah,
I mean, it's an extremist ideology, and I think this would totally destroy the Democratic Party.
Yeah,
and that's why a lot of people like Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and Barack Obama are shooting darts at Bernie right now, subtle darts, but they're not so subtle anymore, actually, because, I mean, Hillary said, I don't like him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And John Kerry was overheard on the phone saying, oh, he's bringing the party down. And I forgot what Barack Obama said, but he said something nasty, too, about Bernie Sanders. I mean, they're all ganging up on him because they know the consequences that would happen if he turns out to be the candidate. It would be a total nightmare.
James Carville. No? James Carville yesterday. You saw that?
Oh, yeah.
He says, are we the Democrats, do we want to be an ideological cult, or do we want to have a majoritarian instinct to be a majority party? I am scared to death. We've got to get relevant. The urban core is not going to get... No, the urban core, I guess what he means is the intellectual urban progressive core. I guess that's what he's saying.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think also people are underestimating the influence Bernie has had post 2016 on just his ideology has made extremists out of many liberals.
Yeah.
So much so that, like, I mean, you're seeing. I mean, you could see it on Twitter. It's fairly toxic what's happening right now in terms of if you disagree with me, you're a sexist, you're a racist, you're a homophobic. I really think that was Bernie's doing.
Yeah.
It's just the extremist ideology of it all,
yeah.
And you know that's. He's gone into the mainstream, and now he's probably the most popular Democratic candidate out there, which is frightening to think about. But I mean, I used to support Bernie back in 2016, but I mean, I just saw with the result that came with his candidacy,
yeah.
And you know, as much as I didn't like Hillary Clinton as well, I mean, Bernie was no saint. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
all right, I've got to attend to the women who have arrived to help clean up my place, but I'll get this up quickly. And I think thanks for the propellant, the rhetorical propellant as far as revenge porn that got me going. So I'll make something out of that, and I'll put this up with some edits soon, later today.
Yeah, it's 57 minutes. You could easily cut. I don't know how much, but anyway, yeah.
All right, man.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye. Take care. Bye.